The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Can everybody hear me? This is fine, great. I hate standing up on a podium. Great, so thanks so much for being here. Really great turnout. I was not expecting this. This is great. So before I really go into my talk, I just want to say that the talk will mostly focus on Palestinian resistance within Palestine, so within the West Bank, then Israel, and within Gaza, and less on more international resistance and like Palestine resistance in the United States. So I just wanted to put that out there. So I'm going to start with the events that took place on March 30th of this year on Land Day, when the Great March of Return began. It was a Friday. It was to commemorate the 1976 Land Day strikes, which happened in Israel against the extension of the occupation and the expansion and expropriation of Palestinian land. And at the time, Israel killed six Palestinians, and so protests erupted as a result of the killing and at the funeral processions. So about 33 years later, on March 30th, 2018, this year, about 30,000 Palestinians in Gaza marched to the militarized barrier with Israel, demanding their right to return to their occupied homes. Gaza, which is home to about 2 million Palestinians, 70% of which are refugees, and a large portion of which actually live within miles of their now occupied homes. So they live within walking distance of the homes that they grew up in, or that their parents and grandparents grew up in, and that they're banned from, they're barred from. And Gaza is under an 11-year siege, and is occupied by Israel. And so on March 30th, when 30,000 Palestinians went out to protest, it was a mass protest. It was mass civil disobedience, and it was something that we hadn't seen in Palestine in several years. Some would argue in decades. And in response to their peaceful march, Israel stationed snipers, right, on the barrier. This is a barrier that already has barbed wire and all sorts of different drone technology and military technology against these unarmed protesters. Many of these protesters were children, were women, and that day, at least 17 Palestinians were killed in cold blood. And just to kind of put this in perspective, you're talking about 30,000 people, right, marching unarmed, coming from a place that has been assaulted by Israel basically every couple of years. The infrastructure is completely destroyed. Hundreds of schools have been destroyed as a result of the bombings in 2012 and 2014. Most people have access to electricity for about 4 hours a day. Most don't even have access to water. And over 40% of the population lives below the poverty line. And the majority of the population is below the age of 25. And in the last 2 years, suicide rates in Gaza have also just been exponentially growing. And so these protests really signified a huge shift in the way Palestinians in Gaza were resisting. And after that first week of protests, Palestinians came out the second week, the second Friday, and the Friday after that, and the Friday after that. And originally the Great March of Return protests were planned for 6 weeks, from March 30th until May 15th, which marked the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, right, or the catastrophe, when the ethnic cleansing campaigns in Palestine began, when Israel destroyed over 400 villages and displaced over 750,000 Palestinians. And that's when the State of Israel was declared. But I'm not going to get too much into that. What I really want to paint is a picture of what these Great March of Return protests looked like. So you had five huge encampments that were built on this militarized border by these Palestinians. So thousands of Palestinians were living there, during the entire period of the protests. The different tents were named after villages that had been occupied. And all sorts of, you know, like everyday life continued at this barrier. So you had committees that were in charge of distributing food. You had committees that were in charge of distributing medical supplies. People were trained, nurses and doctors came from the hospitals and stationed themselves at the cities. Journalists did the same. There were women's committees who were in charge of all sorts of things, from social services, but also to like engage in political debate and decide what strategies they should that should be used at the border. And so it was extremely, extremely organized when you compare it to what we've seen in the region in the last several years. And although in the mainstream media, and of course Israel kept saying, you know, these are organized by Hamas, it's they're going to be violent, whatever, they're terrorists. The reality is these protests were actually organized by workers, by students, by youth who came together and organized these mass marches, and only later did Hamas begin to play a role in, you know, trying to take some of the credit for this mass movement that had begun. The reality is the Great March of Return protests are actually ongoing, right? Last Friday, two Palestinians were killed on the border, and tomorrow they're ongoing. There are protests planned for tomorrow. So it's been 3 months now of these Great March of Return protests. And I want to really emphasize the women's committees, because I think women are really at the forefront of the Great March of Return protest. And I think that's really important to emphasize, because that's often kind of downplayed and dismissed, right? Because it becomes difficult for the mainstream to produce this narrative of these are terrorists, these are violent protesters, when you see these women and children, right, with balloons and kites at the barrier. And I'm sure a lot of you have heard of Razan Najjar. She was a Palestinian nurse, 20-year-old Palestinian nurse, who was volunteering her time to tend to the wounded at the Great March of Return protests. And she was shot in the back as she was going with her team to get an injured protester and take him back to the medical tent. And before she was killed, she had been interviewed by the New York Times. And one of the things that she said, she has this really great quote, this really powerful quote to show you, you know, what it means to be a Palestinian woman who resists the occupation, how central that is to the role of resistance, to Palestinian resistance. She said, quote, "I want to prove to the world that we women are socially active and that we play a big role in the community. I want to be a great nurse who everybody knows of. The power that we have, even mountains can't break down." And Razan was shot and killed by Israeli forces during the Great March of Return protests. And she is one of many nurses and doctors who were deliberately targeted, and one of many journalists, in addition to journalists who were also targeted. So of course, Israel's response was, you know, vicious and ruthless. Not only were they met with snipers, but they were met with snipers using butterfly bullets, which are a specific type of bullet that's actually supposed to be illegal, but which basically just creates life-threatening injuries or causes permanent damages, forcing a lot of people to have their different limbs amputated. And when snipers weren't shooting to kill, they were using drones that had just been recently developed in 2018 in Israel. These were drones that rained tear gas. So they were developed, they were basically experimented on Palestinians during the Great Return March, and then Israel will export them to the world, to the arms market. So after the initial massacre, a few weeks into it, Israel released a tweet on Twitter saying, basically taking responsibility for everyone it had killed. And the tweet read, quote, "Yesterday we saw 30,000. We arrived prepared with precise reinforcement. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed," end quote. They quickly deleted that tweet, but the fact that the Israeli Defense Forces tweeted that publicly on Twitter, I think just goes to show you know, how confident they are in their project and in what they're doing, and how unafraid they are of what the response will be, especially now that they have more and more imperial powers backing them. And of course, you know, various Israeli officials released statements saying that every Palestinian in Gaza was a terrorist, meaning every Palestinian could be killed without, you know, without the Israeli soldiers really, you know, being held accountable. Now I paint this picture of, you know, the Great March of Return, these various committees that were a part of it, how organized it was, how massive it was. And then I want to kind of frame that in the history of Palestinian resistance. And to do that, I want to go back about 30 years to 1987, when the first Intifada began. And before I do that, I just want to quickly say that, you know, Palestinians have been resisting long before, obviously, the Great Return March, but also long before the first Intifada and the second Intifada. In fact, they resisted long before 1948, when the ethnic cleansing campaigns began. There were various strikes in the 30s and revolts, and even earlier against the British Mandate. But that what I want to do in this talk is actually try to situate the Great March of Return in particular in the events of the First Intifada, and how the First Intifada and the aftermath of the First Intifada led to where we are today. And that will make more sense in a little bit. So the First Intifada began in 1987, and it was triggered on December 8th, when an Israeli vehicle ran over four Palestinian workers living in a refugee camp in Gaza. And all four of these Palestinian workers died. And there's a huge funeral procession that was organized to sort of commemorate the workers. And at the funeral procession, Israeli forces fired into the crowd of Palestinians, and they killed a 17-year-old boy. And that sparked a huge, like, popular uprising that began in Gaza, but then spread throughout the West Bank. And though it was triggered by the funeral procession, it had actually been brewing for several decades, this discontent, this tension. And it was a result of several factors. The first was the fact that Palestinians were completely under the economic control of Israel. They were completely reliant on the Israeli state for their work, for all of their resources. So that was the first. And the noose around them was sort of tightening. The second was the effects of the Lebanese Civil War, which had played out in the prior decade. And aside from just the direct, you know, the fact that there was the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, you know, Palestinian refugee camp, but there are other really important factors during the Lebanese Civil War that also affected the occupation of Palestine. I'm not going to get too much into that, but it's good to have that in mind. And then the third was the fact that the occupation was intensifying, right? And there was less and less international condemnation of what was happening in Israel. And then the last was just the erasure of Palestinian identity. It was in the decade prior to the beginning of the First Intifada where the word Palestine was just completely censored, right, in all textbooks, not just in Israel, but also in surrounding countries. For example, Jordan, that has a huge Palestinian refugee population. They used to have an entire book dedicated to the study of, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that book was wiped out, and a lot of the history of Palestine was censored. So it was all of these. In addition to, and this is the last point, about 4,000 Palestinian activists, political activists, had been imprisoned in the decade prior to the first Intifada. So all of these resulted in this complete breakout, right? This Intifada. Intifada actually means uprising. It kind of means, you know, when you have like a mat and you just kind of go like that with it. That's what Intifada actually means in Arabic. And these protests quickly turned into mass mobilizations, right, with tens of thousands marching and demanding an end to the occupation. And that was a very concrete demand that the Intifada was calling for. It was calling for an end to the occupation. And there were boycotts and strikes, and cities and towns and villages across the occupied West Bank and Gaza began to organize themselves to resist the impending attacks from Israel. And in the earliest weeks of the Intifada, there were solidarity protests across the Middle East, right, in Egypt and Jordan and Morocco and Iraq, and even in Saudi Arabia and a few other Gulf states. And the sentiment ran so deep that some of the Arab regimes actually began to speak out against the Israeli occupation. They issued statements of support, which was actually very unusual in that period. So as the Intifada spread, what happened is these unified popular committees began to rise in villages and cities across the West Bank. They had democratic councils that took over organizing protests and strikes. Leaflets would be printed out and distributed across the villages and towns. Secret ballots to elect board members for these popular committees traveled from family to family. Often they would be hidden in women's clothing so that they wouldn't be searched, because the men were often searched. Entire towns boycotted Israeli products, and entire towns participated in tax strikes. Withheld their taxes from Israel. Now, as they did this, it required a lot of organizing, because where are you going to get your food when you usually rely on Israel for your food or your water or other goods? So they set up food committees to come up with ways to grow food and obtain resources that Israeli products usually provided. Roof gardens sprang up in apartment buildings and houses. Anyone who owned plots of land donated them to these committees, and these committees repurposed them and distributed them among the village or town members. For meat, Palestinians resorted to raising rabbits because they reproduced quickly, and so they had an abundance of meat, and they were easy to distribute. And there were special distribution committees, aside from the food committees, which were tasked with ensuring every home in need of food had its supplies. And this often meant, traveling at night or figuring out ways to evade curfews and raids. And the popular committees kept watch over the villages and refugee camps to protect them from these Israeli raids and attempts to destroy the water and food supply. So often Israeli forces would raid a village, go up to the roof, destroy the gardens, or kill all of the animals in order to force Palestinians to end their boycott or end their strike. One is like food, right, and distribution of resources. And then the other big part of this was also like hospitals and medical supplies. So as this was happening, of course, there were many, many injuries because Israeli forces would respond, as we would expect them to, with violence. And so because hospitals were often invaded by Israeli forces and the wounded would be detained for participating in protests, what Palestinians did is they set up mobile clinics and alternative underground medical centers, often in people's homes or in repurposed buildings. And they would, and doctors would be brought from the different cities and villages and sort of distributed so that every area had medical staff. And when doctors began to be arrested, basically they trained thousands of volunteers to be nurses and to help provide medical services. One thing they would use in these medical centers in case of a raid is that they would use anonymity, or they'd give people fake names so that if the hospital was raided, nobody would actually know who was there. And this required a lot of organization, because part of that was the fact that they needed blood, right? At the time when the first Intifada began, Israel was spending, I think, $6 on every Palestinian and $600 on every Israeli citizen in healthcare. And so what this meant is, they didn't have any medical supplies, right? And so when the Intifada began, one of the things that they urgently needed was blood. They needed blood donations. And what happened is Palestinians inside Israel, who had more access to resources, would send blood banks into the West Bank and Gaza. They would coordinate with the committees and send blood. And what this required was a very extensive blood donor network. That's exactly what they produced. It was called the Blood Donor Network, where they would have data on where this blood was coming from, what type it was, etc. It's actually really interesting. All of this data was housed on a single computer that was shared. There was just one computer between Gaza and the West Bank. And it was shared so that they could store all this data. And so if anybody needed, this or that type of blood, they would basically cross-check it with whatever was in that computer. That was an interesting thing that I came upon when I was doing research. So not only did these committees provide medical services and food, but they also took it upon themselves to do like social services that they would rely on Israel to do, but that because of the boycott, Israel was not doing. So a really basic example is like garbage collection, right? They organized themselves to make sure that the garbage was collected so that it just didn't stay out in the streets. And to communicate across villages and towns, especially when Israeli forces were constantly raiding them or stations outside, Palestinians used flyers, right, that they distributed at night. But another thing they used is graffiti. There was this entire system of graffiti across the West Bank and Gaza that was used to communicate. So basically, Palestinian youth would be tasked with spray painting a message across a specific wall to indicate when a strike was going to happen, when a protest would start, or when they thought Israelis were coming to raid a village. And this was so commonly used that a lot of Palestinians kept a bucket of white paint outside of their homes because Israeli forces would force them to paint over the graffiti. So it was common to see white paint buckets outside of people's homes. Another way they disseminated messages is through street vendors. So a street vendor, let's say someone selling vegetables, in the middle of this street vendor calling different names of vegetables, there would be a message like the strike is this day or the protest will start at this time. So that was another way that they would communicate. And so grassroots leadership became a very real and legitimate alternative to existing institutions. And you know, the First Intifada lasted 6 years. So it was a long time. It wasn't just a few days. And though it's often remembered, you know, I don't know how many people here had heard about the First Intifada or, you know, seen photos that are often attributed to it. But it's often remembered with, you know, pictures of children throwing stones or like tires burning or the Molotov cocktails. But the reality is there's this entire network of people like organizing their resistance, right, and organizing for their liberation and for an end to the occupation. And one thing that children actually did do other than throw rocks was they flew kites with the Palestinian flag. And they did that, it's very deliberate, because the Palestinian flag was banned. You were not allowed to fly the Palestinian flag. So anytime the Palestinian flag was seen anywhere, it was taken down by Israeli soldiers, or Palestinians were forced to take it down. So one thing that the kids would do to provoke the soldiers is they would fly these kites and let them go. And if you've been following the news recently about Gaza, that's something that's happening now, where they're flying these Palestinian flag kites. So that's wow. Okay. So very briefly, I just quickly want to talk about the role of women in the First Intifada. Even more so, I would say, than the Great Return March, the role the Palestinian women played in the First Intifada was very crucial. I actually would go so far as to say that the success and the length of the First Intifada is in large part a result of the persistence and the activity of Palestinian women in that six-year period. They organized, a lot of them organized the political committees. They posed as social service groups that came together to knit, to cook. But in reality, what they would be doing is they'd be having very intense and in-depth political debates about strategy and tactics. And in part, this was because a lot of the men were in jail. Like, it was like a lot of what ended up happening is, you know, in some of the most active villages and towns, the men would all be taken to jail. The women would end up taking over these committees and creating these leadership bodies. And then people from other villages would come and they would ask for advice from these women's committees on how to implement different types, different strategies in their own town. And another thing that they did is basically sneak in red and white and green and black string, and they would knit Palestinian flags that in the morning would be raised to provoke the soldiers. And in the words of one Palestinian activist, Sama Awede, she said, quote, "We cannot be free as women until we are free, until we are in a free country," end quote. And I think that's something that most Palestinian women would agree with. And so the third aspect that I want to mention is schools and universities. So schools and universities were also shut down during the First Intifada. Israelis used that as an attempt to stop the strikes and the boycotts. And so women organized underground schools and classes. And they would be conducted in people's homes, on roofs, in olive groves. And so schooling continued, basically. You know, people like went to class. And this continued again throughout the 6 years of the Intifada. And then there were other like collective strategies that were used against, you know, the detention of children or even men. So one thing that women would do is anytime a child was being detained or arrested, anyone passing by would just kind of jump on the child and say, no, this is my kid, like this is my son or this is my daughter, why are you taking them? And the same with the men. They would say, no, this is like my brother or this is my husband, why are you taking them? And they would be able to keep them from getting detained. That said, many women were arrested, and many pregnant women were arrested, and there was a lot of sexual assault against women in Israeli detention. So I wanted to go into the example of the village of Beit Suhur, which I think is like a very, it's just like such an inspiring example of organizing and resistance in Palestine, but I don't really have time, so I won't. I'm sorry. It's so sad. It's one of, you know what, I'm gonna do it. Okay. So Beit Suhud is just such an amazing example, I think it's of what the first Intifada looked like. So Beit Suhud is home to about 120,000 Palestinians, and for 6 weeks, almost the entire population of Beit Suhud went on a tax strike using the slogan, no taxation without representation. That was actually their slogan. And the village basically organized every member of its population, from students to, you know, doctors and lawyers, all of its workers, to make sure that the tax strike continued. And in response to the tax strike, what Israel did is it imposed a curfew, a 42-day curfew, during which the entire village was occupied. And what Israel did is it actually went from house to house, confiscating people's properties, saying that this is how it was going to pay for the taxes that they owed. And of course, they confiscated way more than anything that was owned. Some people put the estimates at 1 million in property, which, you know, they didn't know that much. Anyway, Beit Suhud was very distinct in its level of organizing and its level of democracy. They protected political prisoners. They would hide them and sort of have them go from house to house when there was a raid. They worked collectively to persist in the tax strike, and it was one of the last towns to end its participation in the Intifada. It was one of the last places that continued to say, no, the Intifada should continue, we shouldn't accept peace talks until the very end. And as a result, a lot of the leadership of these committees were actually arrested and tortured by the Palestinian Authority later on. And one funny story, there's this great film called The Wanted 18, which actually tells the real story of something that happened in Beit Suhud, which is that the town bought 18 cows to provide milk and food for the population. In Israel, Israeli forces, they convened a committee, right, called the Want, and they convened a committee and they launched the Wanted 18 campaign, where they basically attempted to find these 18 cows. Which Palestinians hid. So just to get a sense of to what extent Israeli forces are willing to go. So I can't go more into Beit Suhud, unfortunately, but it's you should read about it, and we can talk about it in the discussion. So the Intifada mobilized and organized all sectors of Palestinian societies in ways that armed resistance hadn't been able to. And it was hugely successful before it was completely co-opted and squashed by Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. But its strength and its character and its confidence, I think, is still very important to remember, especially as we think about what Palestinian resistance looks like today. Before I just kind of transition into that, I just want to, you know, it was very inspiring, it was very organized, but the response by Israel was actually very, very ruthless and very vicious. So over the course of the 6 years, 1,000 people were killed, 120,000 people were wounded, including 29,000 children who were wounded critically, 600,000 people, so that's over 500,000 people were jailed during that period. And during the 4 years of the uprising, 70,000 Israeli forces were stationed in the West Bank and Gaza. 70,000. And then the most famous thing I think about that period is the fact that Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister at the time, enforced the broken bones policy, in which he basically commanded Israeli forces, because they couldn't shoot to kill, because the international community had begun to condemn Israel, the policy was, you know, use rocks that they're throwing at you and break their bones. And at the time, there's a famous video that spread of a Palestinian child having his bones, his arm broken with a rock. So all this to say is that they responded very violently to what was largely non-violent resistance. And I think all of this also contributed to another major factor that differentiated the Intifada from prior resistance movements in Palestine, in that the Intifada helped shift the narrative within Israel and within the Jewish community internationally. And in many ways, so did the Great Return March, and I'll get to that later, but there are a lot of similarities in how the Great Return March also participated in kind of shifting the narrative in the mainstream. So, you know, when Palestinians were going out to protest in the Intifada and Israeli soldiers were using, you know, lethal violence against them, and it was videotaped, right, and it spread, more and more Israeli citizens, right, citizens of Israel, Jewish citizens of Israel, began to speak out against the occupation. And it was actually very divisive in that it split a lot of Israeli society because suddenly they began to see Palestinians as humans. Right, they began to see these Palestinian children not as terrorists, but as humans. And so there were protests against the Israeli government during that period. Can't get too much into that today, but here's a good, you know, statistic. At the beginning of the Intifada, the number of refusnik, which are people who refuse to serve in the Israeli forces, was about 160. 6 months in, the number was 600. So it was, you know, it rose by six times in that 6 month period. And one Israeli professor at Hebrew University at the time, he attempted to caution the Israeli government, and he wrote a letter, and one of the things he says in the letter is, quote, "An army can be an army, but an army cannot beat a people," end quote. And I think that's a very, that I feel like that just really reflects and sort of, you know, paints a picture of what the Intifada was all about. So, shifting now to the Palestinian Liberation Organization at the time, which was considered the leadership, you know, body in Palestine, they were exiled in Tunisia, and so they actually caught wind of the Intifada later. And what they attempted to do is they used the Intifada as a bargaining chip. They used it as a way to achieve a compromise with Israel that would put them in charge of with the West Bank and Gaza, and that would basically further entrench the apartheid system. Okay. So, you know, and here we talk about the Oslo peace process, right? The Oslo peace process completely took the wind out of the Intifada. Suddenly Israel was seen as this peacemaker, and the PLO just turned its back on all the Palestinians, and it sold them out. And what's really crazy is that at the time, you know, as these peace talks were beginning to happen, there was actually calls by the different committees in the West Bank and Gaza for a national referendum on whether or not these peace talks could continue. And of course, that was completely ignored. And instead, what happened is that Yasser Arafat, he ended up going behind, you know, in secret to Oslo, Norway, which is, the talks are named after that, and basically accepting a deal with Israel and the United States. And this deal, it left out all of the important factors that actually matter to Palestinians. Everything that Palestinians were demanding in the Intifada was ignored. So there was no discussion of Jerusalem. There's no discussion of the right of return of refugees. There was no discussion of the end to illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. All this was ignored, and instead you had what was called the Declaration of Principles, which basically just gave the Palestinian Authority reign over the West Bank and Gaza with direct military rule by Israel. So in essence, it just further entrenched the apartheid rule under this guise of peace. And in fact, Yitzhak Rabin would later win a Nobel Peace Prize for these so-called peace talks. I think it's important to understand, like, why this happened. You know, Yasser Arafat is often remembered as this, like, Palestinian hero, but the reality is that Yasser Arafat didn't see Palestinian liberation the way Palestinians did, right? His vision for Palestine in no way aligned with that of the Intifada. from his rise in the 70s to the PLO, he constantly attempted to kind of frame himself and the Palestinian movement within the regional and the international ruling classes. So his strategy was, you know, to frame Palestinian liberation and statehood in ways that were beneficial to the interests of the ruling classes of the region and of the overall interest of Western imperialist and capitalist rulers. And of course, this was impossible because the very root of Palestinian resistance, right, is anti-colonial, is anti-imperialist. And so it's precisely this type of strategy that Arafat envisioned that led him to sign the Oslo Accords. And then about a decade later, for him and his followers to work with the US to suppress the Second Intifada. So during Oslo, tens of thousands of Palestinians lost their jobs, the number of Israeli settlements doubled, Palestinian life just deteriorated. And anyone who spoke out against the Oslo Accords was tortured by the Palestinian Authority, of course, working with Israel. And it was during this time that, how am I doing on time?
You're almost at 35.
Okay, it was during this time that Hamas began to rise because it was one of the groups that was against the peace accords while the PA was not. And I want to mention just very briefly, I can get into it, that there were other groups that also spoke out against the Oslo Accords. You know, the PFLP, the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Anyway, there were different groups, like on the left, that spoke out. Unfortunately, they were very disorganized, and they were in many ways they were very sectarian, so they failed. So there was no alternative to the rise of Hamas at the time, that seemed to be the only group against this sellout. And so it was the failure of the First Intifada and the PLO's Oslo Accords that led to the Second Intifada. I'm not going to actually have time to go into the Second Intifada at all. What I will say is that, unlike the first, it was characterized by more intense military campaigns. And I don't mean necessarily by Palestinians, but in fact by Israelis. It was during the Second Intifada that Jenin refugee camp was attacked. It was during the Second Intifada that Operation Defensive Shield, which is the largest Israeli military operation at the time since 1967, where they killed over 1,400 Palestinians. And it's important to say that at the time, the Palestinian Authority said nothing and did nothing to try to stop these military campaigns against Palestinians from happening. In fact, this was right after 9/11, and right after 9/11, when the whole rhetoric of the war on terror came up, the Palestinian Authority actually released statements saying that it wanted to help the United States in its campaign to fight terrorism. So they just, and it also supported the war on Afghanistan in 2003. So this just gives you a sense of like where the Palestinian Authority was at and what was actually happening on the ground to Palestinians. I have to skip a lot. So I'm gonna just kind of fast forward to the uprisings in 2011. The uprisings in 2011, I think, were very, you know, they're very inspiring. You had all of these, you had Arab workers across the Middle East rising up against tyrants and dictators, from Hosni Mubarak to King Abdullah of Jordan to Bashar al-Assad. But the fact is that the counter-revolution, right, was well-funded, it was strong, and a lot of these were squashed, although some were ongoing. And so what Israel was able to do during that time, within 2 years of the uprisings in 2011, is it launched two military campaigns against Gaza, each worse than the one before. The first was Operation Pillar of Defense, and then 2 years later, Operation Protective Edge. And it was after these two that Gaza was left with no infrastructure, with absolutely, I mean, it was just, there was nothing left. And that's what Gaza is living with today, and that's kind of, that's part of what we need to think about when we think about why the Great March of Return happened. So I kind of laid all of this out because I think when we think about the First Intifada and how inspiring it was and how organized it was and how the Oslo Peace Accords and the leadership, Palestinian leadership, completely demobilized, right, and squashed the Intifada, it helps you understand what we're seeing today with the Great March of Return and why it is that we haven't seen organization in that way for over 20 years. And why the Great March of Return is so important and so inspiring, even if it has led to so many deaths, and even if it's not being treated internationally, but also within the Middle East in the way that we would want to, in terms of mass protests and solidarity, etc. But there's so much to learn from the First Intifada, and I'm going to begin to end here. I think the first and most important thing is the BDS movement. The BDS movement in 2005. In many ways was inspired by the First Intifada, all of these organized committees, right, and unions that as a result of the First Intifada were able to come together and call and launch the call for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which was a nonviolent way to resist the occupation and put pressure on Israel. And even though, you know, it seems today like Israel is just stronger than it's ever been before, especially now that it has the backing, the very confident backing of Trump and other figures. The reality is that BDS is winning, the Palestinians are winning when you look at the greater picture. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. So just to go back to the Great March of Return, what this just shows is that, you know, this sudden outburst of marches actually is within a larger framework and timeline of Palestinian resistance. And that the last year has actually been an affirmation of Israel's goals to fully occupy all of Palestine, including the West Bank, right? I mean, in the last year alone, we've seen the Al-Aqsa protests in July of last year, or in June of last year, settlement expansion since Trump came to office, 14,000 new settlement units have been approved. The embassy moved to Jerusalem, which of course, I think, you know, beyond anything else, just really shows that Trump is colluding with other states in the region. We saw Ahed Tamimi, right, 17-year-old Palestinian girl who was detained and then imprisoned, forced to plead guilty, and is now serving 8 months in jail, while at the same time, an Israeli soldier named Ilor Azaria was just released this week, actually, and he's someone who shot a Palestinian who's incapacitated and killed him, and it was caught on video, and he was released after serving a few months in jail, and when he actually returned to the scene of that shooting, he was there was basically a party there welcoming him back. Great, I'm gonna be done in 5 minutes. So, there are so many similarities between the Great Return March, what we're seeing today, and the First Intifada. So then the obvious question is, what comes next, right? So unlike the First Intifada, we're not dealing with a Palestinian authority that is strong, right, and that can actually co-opt and usurp this movement. In fact, what we're seeing is a very weak Palestinian authority that has completely lost the trust of all Palestinians. And it's, you know, it spent the last two decades implementing all these neoliberal policies, squashing popular resistance, collaborating with Israel, collaborating with the U.S. And so it's mostly, you know, it seems to be out of the picture in terms of what comes next. And then second, we also have Hamas, who used to have some sort of legitimacy, which has also now lost all legitimacy. You know, it had nothing to do with planning the Great March of Return protests. We have this right-wing government in Israel that's growing stronger and stronger. And we have these counter-revolutions that have just completely weakened the working class in the Middle East. So what, you know, what next? What does Palestinian resistance look like next? And this is actually a question I'm still grappling with, and I don't have fully formed answers. But there are three, I think, important things to keep in mind. The first is the importance of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, which has just been growing. In the last, I'd say, 2 years alone, it's grown exponentially. I mean, celebrities are speaking out against Israel, people you would never expect, right? You have more and more campuses divesting. You have more and more cities, right? Like entire cities calling for divestment. In Spain, in the last 3 months, three cities, including one of Spain's largest cities, Valencia, completely divested from Israel. It called it. So you have the BDS movement, and then the second thing is it's just important to remember that all the Arab states play a very large role in the occupation, right? Many Arab states, I don't have time. Many Arab states play a very large role in the occupation, and they've spent basically half a decade just waging this counter-revolutionary war on activists, on workers, on youth across the region from Syria to Yemen to suppress and murder any sort of revolutionary movement. And of course, this has created obstacles for workers to rise up and defend Palestinians. But it's also important to remember that, you know, this won't last forever. Like we saw with the Great Return March, that it seemed to come out of nowhere, but in fact it had been brewing for some time. It's only a matter of time before something else like this happens. And I think the same can be said about the Arab Spring. It looked like it was just this sudden spring, but it wasn't. It was brewing for some time. There were a lot of factors that led to the events of 2011, which means the Palestinians are going to resist. And the Great March of Return is just such a good example, where you have Palestinians being slaughtered every week, and then the next week they come out again. And so I think the way that we need to think about Palestinian liberation, and the way we need to think about the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, has to be understood within the larger framework of the Middle East and of the liberation of the entire region. And what this means concretely is that resistance needs to include the working class, and needs to include the Arab working class, right? It needs to include sympathy with the movements that are happening in Syria, in Yemen, in Egypt. But in particular, I think I want to emphasize Syria, right? That, you know, being pro-Palestine, right, fighting for Palestinian liberation necessitates fighting for the liberation of Syrians who are, you know, fighting this tyrant Bashar al-Assad for 7 years now. And of course, with Egyptians against Sisi and with Jordanians against Abdullah. So any strategy that aims to liberate Palestinians needs to include building this type of solidarity. And with the BDS movement, it means framing BDS in anti-imperialist terms and thinking about it in that way. Because if we don't do that, we're actually not going to achieve any sort of liberation in Palestine. You know, calling for a one state in Palestine, one democratic state, that can't happen without there being a revolution within the country that will automatically affect the countries in the region. And vice versa. Great, okay. And then I'll just end by saying, I think sometimes it can feel very daunting to think about, well, you know, this, it's gonna take some time before there's actually any sort of big revolution that can actually liberate all of these countries, since their fates are tied to one another. But just like we weren't expecting it with the Arab Spring, just like we weren't expecting it with the Intifada, just like we weren't expecting it with the Great Return March, things are triggered at, you know, at the most unexpected moments. And when they are, we need to be ready to be a part of it and to support it and to make those connections that others may not make or that may miss. And I guess the last thing I'll end with, I said that too many times, last thing I'll end with is that the real fear that Israel has, the real fear that Bashar al-Assad has, the real fear that all of these states have, including like Mahmoud Abbas, right, and the Palestinian Authority, their biggest fear isn't Saudi Arabia, their biggest fear isn't Iran, even though they keep saying that. Their biggest fear is actually the Arab working class in the region, right? Palestinian, Syrian, Yemeni, Lebanese, Jordanian. That is their biggest fear. And so when they rise, that we can achieve that liberation that we're calling for, that liberation that BDS is calling for. I'll end there.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.